This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Hello, sister, are you there?
I'm here.
We may be on the air. This is Steve Shoemaker of Keeping the Faith, and our guest tonight is Sister Mary Ellen Lacey. We're going to be talking about NEPWRC, a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby that operates out of Washington, D.C. Sister Mary Ellen recently spoke at the University of Illinois at the University Y about the nuns on the bus, and we're going to discuss that and other issues being faced by NEPWRC these days. We're talking with Sister Mary Ellen Lacey by phone.
Hi.
And Mary Ellen, I'm not sure exactly, maybe I should tell listeners a little bit about your background. You're, among other things, an attorney and a registered nurse, as well as a daughter of charity, and we'll explore what that means in just a minute. How is the connection there? Are you hearing me all right?
I'm hearing you real well, thanks.
Great. We are having a severe winter storm here in the Midwest, and western Indiana and central and eastern Illinois are experiencing a major storm. As a result, I am not in the studio, and I might tell listeners, if you have reception problems on your AM radio, you have a couple alternatives. If you have an HD radio, you can go to HD3 at 90.9 FM, WILL FM, or, of course, you can listen online at will.illinois.edu. Many of you will still have a strong AM reception, but we know with severe storms like this, sometimes that does affect your ability to listen. And, of course, the show will be archived and available to listen at your convenience on a podcast after probably just a couple days, maybe even tomorrow. Well, let's get right into talking with Sister Mary Ellen Lacey. Tell us how 40 years, the NEPWRC has been in existence 40 years. You received all sorts of awards. How did it get started?
Well, what happened was about 40 years ago, there was 47 sisters who came together, and they had all had been providing direct service and charity. And that's a lot of what most sisters' orders do. We provide direct service to those who suffer from poverty. These sisters had been doing it for some time, and just they came to realize that while charity is important, we actually need to change the structures and the systems that create the injustice that make it necessary for people to require charity. So in thinking of how they could serve God in this fashion, the sisters came about and they decided, you know what, we need to be in D.C. We need to affect these laws. We need to impact the structures that cause the injustice, that cause the poverty. And to do that, we need to start our own lobby. We need to have a lobby for those who suffer from poverty. And they left behind two sisters in D.C. with, I think, a budget of $86. And the sisters who started the NEPWRC stayed there, and they began lobbying for programs and services for people who live in poverty. And sisters, other orders contributed. It was predominantly funded by other orders because those sisters saw the direct effects of people suffering from poverty and knew that the systems needed to be changed if we were to work our way out of a job, so to speak. You know, nobody wants to have to give charity. And that was the idea, was to aim for more of a global perspective or at least a national perspective in this instance. So they continue to work at it.
The leadership, what's now called the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, helped begin the group? Is that accurate?
No, I don't believe, not to my knowledge. That's not
okay.
My understanding of it. This was a group of 47 sisters who had come together. And it was not connected to LCWR as a leadership membership. It's a different organization altogether.
I've been reading about your history, but I need to confess to you, sister, I'm a Protestant, and so some of the language is new to me.
That's right. Oh, I know it, yeah. And just correct me if I ever say something that you're like, whoa, we don't use that language.
No,
I was
fine.
Mentioned in the South for a bit, so I know that I'm used to a little bit of the different languages. But
We do have a very diverse listening audience here in the Midwest at this regional NPR program. And we've had many Catholics on the program before, but I do have to admit my ignorance on some things. For example, tell us about the Daughters of Charity.
Well, the Daughters of Charity is an international congregation of, it's a society of apostolic life, which means we are sisters who come together and we serve Jesus and the person who is poor. So a Daughter of Charity would give her life to God in community in service to the poor. We were founded by St. Vincent de Paul and Louise de Marillac in France. And we're in 90 countries.
Thank you. And I noticed your current network executive director, Sister Simone Campbell, is from a different religious order. What is hers?
She's a sister of social service out of California.
Okay.
Her founder was actually one of the first female members of parliament in Hungary.
I want to talk about your lobbying and the issues that you're concerned with. But before that, we do that, we just have this one current topic that's on everyone's mind, of course, since a new pope has been selected. Yeah. And what has been the talk around the network as Pope Francis was selected?
You know what? I haven't heard anyone have any other response but hope. You know, he just presents himself first and foremost as a humble man. You know, his first act was to ask people to pray for him. That speaks volumes about the nature of the man. You know, he's humble, and then his next act was to give forgiveness to everybody, a plenary indulgence of sorts. So he is forgiving and humble, and he's had recent experience with the poor. And I think for me and many of those who I work with, that is the most hopeful thing about this pope. He knows what it is to walk with the poor. He has had recent pastoral experience, and I think that is Jesus' message. I bring good news to the poor. And now we have a leader, and not that other leaders didn't know, but we have one who has had such recent contact with Jesus Christ and the person who's poor that it provides just a different glimmer, you know, a different direction. And it's just fabulous that a Jesuit would take the name of Francis. You know, you've got the intellectual and the justice mind of a Jesuit and the humility and the love of the poor of Francis. It's just a fabulous combination, and it just is a beautiful direction for our Catholic Church to be going in right now.
Let me remind listeners that this is a live call-in program every Sunday evening here on WILL AM 580. And if you have a question or comment for Sister Mary Ellen Lacey, our guest today representing the National Catholic Social Justice Network, do give us a call. If you're in the 217 area code, 333-9455 will get you to our studio, and our technical director, who's working overtime today, Kyle Croa, will answer the phone and get you in line to talk live on the air with Sister Mary Ellen. If it's a long-distance call for you, if you're listening in other places in Indiana and other places in Illinois, outside 217, use an 800 number. That's a toll-free call at 800-222-9455. So, within the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, listening area, 333-WILL, long-distance 1-800-222-WILL 9455. We're always eager to have listeners join the conversation. Ask a question, make a comment. All we ask is you keep it relatively short so we can get as many calls in as possible. And again, because of severe weather, we realize some listeners may be having difficulty hearing, so we may not get as many calls today. But, of course, our podcast is heard by thousands, and you can do that if you've got problems hearing us live on the air. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the issues that caused the nuns to get on the bus. How did that come about?
Well, what had happened was in the spring of last year, we'd celebrated our 40th anniversary, and everyone was excited about that. But a big question was, how do we get more involved? How do we get our name more out there, a little bit more popularity so that we become more powerful lobbyists and, you know, we could be more potent up at the Hill? And then at the same time as this, we had our 40th anniversary, Paul Ryan had released his budget, and his budget predominantly attempted to balance the budget on the backs of the poor. It was everything. It decimated social safety net programs while adding money to the Pentagon spending. And shortly after that, the Catholic bishops had denounced it. And then the Vatican assessment came about, which put sisters in the limelight or in the notoriety spotlight again. And then deciding how we would respond to Paul Ryan's claim that his budget, which our bishops thought was an immoral document and said so, and wrote a letter as such, Paul Ryan's claiming it was a Catholic in keeping with the Catholic faith. And that appalled us as Catholic sisters, because there is nothing in the Bible or in our belief where we would agree to decimating social safety net programming. So when we had to decide how to respond to all of this information that came to us, we had taken advantage of the notoriety that the Vatican assessment had given us. The Vatican had made an assessment about another group, as you earlier mentioned, the LCWR, but that put all sisters. It gave every sister a lot of notoriety. So we had decided to take advantage of the notoriety, and in grouping our newfound publicity with our general disagreement with the Ryan budget, we came together with a group of people, and we had all faiths, and we had written a faithful budget, an alternative budget, a budget that would have allowed people to continue to eat, people to continue to have housing, but it would also balance it out where we would address all the needs of all the people, not just the impoverished, but everybody. And we did that with many faiths in Washington, D.C. So we decided that we would take our budget on a bus, and we would hold up the very works that Paul Ryan was saying needed to be decimated, needed to be cut. And these would be the works that sisters do, that the sisters take the federal funding and they provide ministries. And we saw things like pantries and after-school program and elderly programs. And we went to these places and we held them out. And we said, this is what these programs that would be cut, this is what they do, this is what they achieve. And then we went after that, we went and we lobbied the representative in that area, and we chose the areas for the people who voted for the budget.
Sister, I want to interrupt you here because we do have our first caller on the line, and I want to include as many questions from others as we can. We'll get back to more details about where you went and where the sisters went and what reception they received. But let's go to line number one for our first caller. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, I wouldn't have even thought this up, except that sister started with a praise of this recent pope, and it seems like his history in Argentina was in direct opposition to the poor, his opposition to liberation theology, and giving credence to those that opposed it in Central America and other places. And I think that you may have reason to fear interference from the Vatican and this pope in any political actions you take in the United States, especially speaking against a budget, which is essentially a political act. So I'll get off and listen.
Were you able to hear that, sister, enough to respond?
I think I heard you referenced the dirty war in Argentina
right.
And the accusations leveled against the Pope.
And raised the issue of liberation theology.
Well, at the time, as I understand it, now this is 30 years ago in a country where there wasn't much great accurate publicity getting out, but liberation theology was closely aligned with Marxism. And that would be, Marxism is not consistent with liberation theology, as I understand it, and that's not consistent with any Catholic beliefs. It's not a, liberation theology does assume that there is God, and it does assume that God wants us to hold up the impoverished person. So that trueness of liberation theology is consistent with the Catholic faith. It's the Marxism that it was wrapped up in at the time this is my understanding of what was going on 30 years ago. Again, we're hearing a lot of stuff that isn't substantiated. So my answer to that is I believe that it was tied up in Marxism at the time, and he was speaking out more against Marxism, and not so much or as its tie with Marxism. With respect to him, I think the caller said something about holding people out responsible or something, or
I couldn't quite hear.
It was something to do with, you know, holding the people or leaving the people. That's an accusation that it really hasn't been founded. As I understand it, the living priest who was involved has said that the account that we're being told by some of the papers is not accurate and that he is not speaking against the Pope in that fashion. I assume he's referring to the two people who were, the two priests who were taken hostage.
Right. Well, let's go back to the topic about response to the sisters who were going out in opposition to the Paul Ryan budget that would be cutting social services so much. How were you received when you went into these districts around, I guess you went to, what, 9 different states? What was the response of the people you talked with?
You know, every single place we went, we were met by people, both Catholics, non-Catholics, but they were hungry for this message. I mean, there were people saying, this is what the gospel is about. We are our brothers and sisters keepers. You know, we do owe each other a responsibility to care for each other. And people were affirming everything that we were saying with respect to, we cannot have an immoral budget or a budget that balances on the backs of the poor. Everybody was just wanting to hear that. They believed it. It brought back the message of Vatican II. It brought back the message of Jesus Christ. Jesus said, I came to bring good news to the poor. And people were happy to hear that the church would get involved with promotion and holding up the impoverished person. And it was just a very positive experience, and people met us with cheers and wanted to come to our fundraiser in the evening. Every place we went, we had just a fundraiser. It wasn't a money raiser. It was just friends. We joined. We talked about our hopes for the Catholic Church, for the United States, and we talked about we the people, and we talked about the 100%, not the 99%, not the 2%, not the 1%, but the 100%, because that's really what it's all about. That was the whole message of the nuns on the bus. It goes back, it's a throwback to Martin Luther King, you know. Anything that is good for you, is good for me. That which hurts me hurts you, because we are that interrelated. You know, if some people are dying of poverty while other people are living this wildly extravagant lifestyle, that is not good for anybody. Now, obviously, the people living wildly extravagant might disagree, but if all of us are doing well, then all of us do better, even the wildly extravagant, and especially those who are living in poverty. There is nothing to be lost by letting everybody do well, and we've gotten ourselves into a situation where we think somebody has to be doing badly for me to be doing well, and that's a mistaken belief. It's not economically correct, and it's not what our Lord would have us believe. You know, before the eyes of God, we are all beggars. So nobody is more deserving than another. It's just you're given a gift, and your gift is to be hopefully used in furtherance of the kingdom. And when we do that, we will be able to enjoy the riches as one person or as one community. And that's the idea, and that's what the nuns on the bus was calling for, people to stop with the entitlement of the opposite means of the entitlements, you know, the entitlements. I'm entitled to my riches and my gifts that God has given me. You know, all is gift. And once you realize that, it's easier for you to give it up a little. But if you don't realize it, you won't give.
On Keeping Faith this afternoon, we're talking live by phone with Sister Mary Ellen Lacey from Washington, D.C. She's a sister in the Daughters of Charity in the Roman Catholic Church. She works with NUTWORK, a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby. We're about a third of the way through our program tonight, and let me give the phone numbers again for people who might like to call in with a comment or question. 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code. If it's long distance, use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's take just a moment and hear about a program coming up here on WILL tomorrow with Jim Meadows. Focus.
When the University of Illinois' Assembly Hall was unveiled in 1963, it was marveled as one of the state's seven wonders of engineering. Monday on Focus, we'll look back at 50 years' worth of U of I and IHSA sporting events, speeches, and concerts. News Gazette prep sports writer Fred Croner is the author of A Saucer Coming to Rest, A Half Century of Assembly Hall. We'll also talk with Kevin Uhlstad, director of the facility for the last 16 years. I'm Jeff Bossert. That's Focus, Monday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580.
Mary Ellen?
Yep.
Mr. Mary Ellen, can you hear me?
Yes, hello.
Very good. This is Steve Shoemaker on Keeping the Faith. I might explain to listeners, we're having a few technical issues because of the storm. One of those issues is that I was unable to get to the studio. I live in the country, and the whiteout made it impossible for me to get to WILL Studios. So we're doing this live broadcast with me from my home phone and Sister Mary Ellen from her phone in Washington, D.C. And we're having a little problem. I couldn't hear just then if our listeners were able to hear the announcement about Focus tomorrow at 10 a.m. on AM 580 with Jim Meadows. I hope so. At any rate, we're back on the air, I presume. we will continue chatting, and I'll be getting an email here shortly to see if we are indeed live. Again, I think we are. Okay, so I do apologize if there are any difficulties for our listeners today because of the extreme storm. And, Sister, I heard from our technical director that when she contacted you, you were having a water problem. What was that?
Oh, no. I said I had to go get some water.
I see. Okay.
No, we're not expecting the bad weather till tomorrow.
So. Okay. Well, it is a major storm. So if listeners in the Midwest are hearing this, do stay off the roads if you possibly can because it's extremely dangerous and you can't see. And we have horizontal winds of 20, 25, 30 mile an hour and
wow.
Heavy snow. So we're expecting about 8 to 10 inches in the region right around Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, for example. But
holy
to get
cow,
back
this
to,
is March.
I know. But to get to back to something perhaps we can do something about, but let's talk a little bit about your background. Before you became a lobbyist I've been taking this message to the halls of Congress in D.C. Tell us how you got to this position. What had you been doing most recently?
Well, you know what? As I said, how the network thing developed.
But you personally, before you came to the network, what were you doing?
I was working charitable acts, and I worked in Mobile, Alabama. I was down in the Bayou La Batre when the Gulf Coast oil spill occurred, the BP oil spill, and I happened to be in the bayou, and down there is a large population of the Vietnamese people who came over after the fall of Saigon, and they maintained a beautiful culture there, but they were shrimpers, oysterers, shuckers, and crabber pickers. So when the BP oil spill came, their culture and their way of life was just decimated. So what I did is I worked with Legal Services of Alabama, and we worked with the Gulf Coast Claims Facility and trying to get people some type of justice in the face of this oil problem. And I worked with that for probably the year and a half or so before I came. But I also worked with immigrants, with immigration law down there. And I learned that, you know, the immigration law, it just doesn't work. You know, there really is no justice for the immigration people stuck in this present immigration system. And prior to working there, I had also worked at El Paso and for a orientation in asylum law there. And, you know, down on the border, I had seen as an immigration attorney just, I mean, and I was there for the briefest of time, literally 5 or 6 weeks. But in those times, I was probably in the court 3-4 times a week, and just time after time you heard story after story of why people came, and our system just, we're just not equipped to handle that. So when I was asked to come to Washington, D.C. to lobby for health care and immigration reform, I was ecstatic because prior to my immigration stuff, I was a nursing home administrator as well as a nurse. So I'd also seen the injustices from a bad system, you know, from Medicare, Medicaid shortages, but also the positive things about that. You know, Medicare is really a pretty effective program, and you hate to see cuts to that.
I need to interrupt you again. We do have another caller, this time on line number 2, from a caller from Urbana. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead. Line number 2.
Hello. Let me preface my question, sister, by saying I agree with your message 100%. However, as delighted as I am to hear that you actually do lobby in these intensely market-driven times with politicians that I feel, it sometimes feels like they are bought and paid for, to use a rather harsh phrase, how effective do you feel you can be? I'll hang up and listen. God bless you.
All right.
Thank you for the call. Go right ahead, sister.
You know what? Great question, and I can almost hear your frustration in it, too, because I feel the same frustration. Obviously, money does pay for a lot of lobbyists in D.C. here, but we've seen, even just by the most recent election, that votes matter, too. People like to say that's naive. They, you know, sister, come on, people's votes don't matter as much. What can my vote do? Well, we saw probably the last election, last fall, where a politician will cater to the white middle class, upper class vote. We saw that women and Hispanics and other minorities are going to make huge difference in the selection of our future politicians. And so while they may not have the money, the power is in the vote, and the power is in organization. And we've seen lately, like in the past 2 or 3 years with the Occupy Wall Street, the nuns on the bus, it really did have a fair modicum of success. We've seen that people want to hear this message. You know, as the caller stated, you know, you agree with the message, too. There are more and more people saying, you know what, not only do I agree about it, I'm willing to risk for it. I'm willing to pay a little more. And that's the uncomfortable part of our message, I think. Yes, we can point to the corporations, and we can point to the higher tax brackets, but everybody needs to feel a little bit of a sting. So even those of us who every day we think we do good, and we do, you know, but there's always just a little bit more we can give. And if we haven't done that, you know, we can't always be pointing fingers. So there has to be both. When we call other people to better behavior, we also have to realize that we're looking in the mirror here too. So we can't just sit comfortable in our charity that we provide. You know, we do have to get into the game. We do have to get in the social justice game. You know, charity is important. Don't get me wrong. As I said, I'm a daughter of charity. I see Christ in the poor, and I couldn't imagine not providing charitable acts. But charity has its limitations, and that calls all of us to fight for justice. And, yeah, the politicians can be, I don't want to say bought and paid for, but I understand what you're saying by that. They're highly influenced by powerful money. But most of it is they can't do it if they don't get reelected. And that's where we say, wait a minute, I do have some power here. And this is, you work for us.
Let me give the phone numbers again for people who would like to talk with Sister Mary Ellen Lacey from NETWRC, a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby. Incidentally, you can find out more information of them online, of course. Go to networklobby.org. Or if you don't have access to a computer, there's a phone number you can use during business hours during the week, 202-347-9797. That's networklobby.org or 202-347-9797, a phone number for during the week. That's in Washington, D.C., of course. To call us here right now live on the 24th of March during a snowstorm in 2013. You may call 333-9455 in 217 area code. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, that's true for many people who are listening on the Internet within the continental U.S. We can't take calls at that 800 number beyond here, and we know we have many international listeners, but we can only take calls at that 800 number in the continental U.S. So that's 800-222-9455. Might just mention next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be having some guests who are students, Muslim students here at the University of Illinois, who have made up a group called the Intercultural Friendship Foundation. And Melikon Tonnery and several others will be here from IFF and talking about Muslim efforts to reach out to those of other religious faiths here in the Central Illinois area at the University of Illinois. And the following week, April 7, 2013, Gene Driscoll, wheelchair athlete of renown, will be our guest. April 14, Guy Jorkin from the UNESCO Center for Global Citizenship. That's coming up on the 14th of April, Sunday night, 5 o'clock, here on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host, and I'm happy to be talking today to Sister Mary Ellen Lacey. Sister, we were talking a little bit about, before that last call, about your concerns with immigration. I know that's sort of a specialty of yours as you lobby there in Washington. What kind of issues do you think are the major problems with the current immigration policy?
Well, right now, the current immigration policy or system is so broken that nothing really can be established. You've got some people waiting 30 years to come over, and all this time they're maintaining an attorney and they're paying fees, and you know, these are extravagant wait times. And you know, we like to tell people, well, you got to get back to the line. Well, they're saying yes, but let's develop a line. And what's exciting right now is that we have a chance at reasonable, compassionate immigration reform with a roadmap to citizenship, which keeps families together. And this is wholly consistent with our faith. You know, we are called to welcome the stranger, and we can do this. You know, we have 11 million people here living in the shadows. I mean, that is not good for anybody. And our values as faith-filled people, whether we're Protestants, Catholics, whatever, you know, Jesus came to eliminate the suffering of the poor, and throwing people into the shadows who are contributing members of our society, most of whom have been here over 10 years. You know, we can do something about this, and Congress is coming together, and our faith values tell us we have to stick up for this right. These people have come, they've contributed, they're our neighbors, they're not strangers anymore. These are our coworkers, these are our neighbors, these are our kids' friends. You know, this system can be fixed, but it has to be really looked at from a perspective of less emphasis. The borders are more safe than they've been in 4 or 5 years. This president has deported more people, many of whom were not even criminals, but at least 400,000 a year are being deported. The border is fairly safe. It's as safe as it's going to be. And to tie citizenship to border safety is just so nebulous. It's just so far off. It's not fixing anything. So that's the one thing with the new Gang of Eight, you know, the bipartisan committee. They're doing fabulous work. And this is what they're pretty much working on now, like how can we get a roadmap to citizenship that's fair, that we secure the borders, but we also, you know, let these people who are here pay their fines, pay their taxes, but stay and live out, you know, outside of the shadows. And that's just better for our workforce. That's better for morale. And it's who we are as Americans. We don't hold some group of people down as lesser than ourselves. That's not who we are. You know, we're better than that. So it's very optimistic. You know, you've got both sides of the table coming together to recognize we need to fix this. This is enough. These people have suffered long enough. These families have been separated too long. We need to come to a reasonable solution. And they seem to be working really hard together and producing things. you know, they've come up with principles. Like I said, that there's, you know, we'd like to see the principles with a clear roadmap to citizenship and uniting families. And there's no reason to think that that's not going to happen because they keep trying. But we just need to keep reminding them that's what we're looking for in this new system, one that works, one that has more cleared time frames, and one that's followed through as it's written. And that's
In reading about your background, I noted that as an attorney, you had represented many people in the immigration process. Tell me, were you an attorney before you were a nurse, and were you in your religious order when you had training for both of those?
No, and the reality is the most immigrants I defended was against BP oil spill, and it wasn't.
I see.
It's funny, it's all a hodgepodge. I actually became a nurse, and then I became an attorney, and then I became a nursing home administrator, and then I became a sister.
Ah, where did you grow up?
It's a circuitous route. I grew up in Chicago, so
I
know many people suffering from your storm right now.
Oh, boy.
I know.
And you grew up in a Catholic family?
Absolutely, yeah. Cradle Catholic and all Catholic schooling. It was very important to my mom.
Which parish, since we have listeners in Chicago?
Oh, Christ the King on the south side. Yeah, definite White Sox fan.
I'll forgive you for that.
Ah, forgive me, no.
My seminary was on the north side, and so we followed the Cubs. When I was in seminary at McCormick in the 60s, we had some very good ecumenical relationships with of course, these at that time it was all males. We didn't have connection with any sisters, unfortunately, but with priests who were in seminary and often had some good discussions on particularly labor issues and economic issues, and we discovered we had many things in common. It was a wonderful time to be in conversation about some of those social justice issues. I'm part of a group out of Chicago. Actually, I've been on the board of the Protestants for the Common Good, and so many of the issues that you've raised are ones that we've lobbied about here at the State House in Springfield, our statewide issues here in Illinois. When you came here to the University of Illinois and spoke at the Y as part of their Friday Forum series earlier this semester, my wife and I were fortunate to be able to hear you, and we're very impressed just with your passion. How do you keep your enthusiasm up when you lose on so many issues you're lobbying for?
Because for me, my belief and my passion for fighting for the justices, because it was born of the acts of charity that I did first. You know, but before, I think you can have a passion for advocacy, you have to know what you're fighting for. And that's why it was so important to me to have a pope who's recently touched the poor, because when you build relationships with people, you know, and as daughters of charity, we learn to see Jesus Christ in the person who is poor. So for me, in serving impoverished people, whether it was in East St. Louis or El Paso, I know that people are living in unjust, horrible situations, and I know them by name. You know, I know little Marquise, who's never seen the same advantages that other white kids his age has seen, and he's begun to figure out, you know, the system's rigged. Some people get more privileges than he does, and he doesn't know why. You know, and there is no real good answer to the why of that. So I think back of the Marquise of this world who don't get to go into the apple orchard first because he has to wait for the public system to give him chaperones. And, you know, I think of, you know, the Davids and the Fams and the people down in Viola Battery who lost a lot of money just because they were little people. You know, that they if somebody wasn't there to fight for them and get their rights and that, they would have suffered and nobody would have known. You know, that's what I think of, you know, the fairness. And it just, I know that this is what Jesus wants. He doesn't want people to live like this, and he wants us to fight. He wants us to stand up and say, this is not what it's about. He has given us gifts. and the gifts he's given to us, he wants us to use in a certain way. But he gave us free will, and we have to answer the call. And when I see the impoverished people in this world and I go to bed, it keeps me up at night. But I am grateful because it's the same reason that gets me up in the morning, too. Because these are the things that we are called to do. I just feel like the more contact you have with a poor person or a person who has never known what it's like to have be food secure. We have 35% of children in our nation not being food secure. That's an abominable statistic, and it should keep us up at night, and it should get us up in the morning. And when we drink our Starbucks and we play with our iPods, we have to be aware that there are people who are wondering where lunch is coming from. And I'm not saying that to give people a guilt trip. It's just we do have to make conscientious choices, we as people of faith.
How does the network, this National Catholic Social Justice Lobby, keep in touch with people who support you and people who you try to energize to also contact their legislators?
We have we send out alerts every Monday to keep people apprised of what's going on the Hill and how that they can be involved, and they can tell their senator or their congressperson, you know, this is what's important to us. We don't want another tax loophole. We don't want another unmanned vehicle. What we'd like is, you know, SNAP to be made secure. We would like food stamps to be certain for these people who are living with, you know, at a $15,000 income for two people. You know, we tend to give, we try to give people all the alerts that are going on. Every Monday we shoot them out, and it's free. Anybody is welcome to just go to our website and network.lobby or networklobby.org and just sign up for the alerts. And then, you know, you could vote on or send messages to your congresspeople and tell them how you'd like them to vote. And we try to keep in touch with the people that we work with, the sisters, like the nuns on the bus. Right now I also work with Medicaid expansion. We have little teams of nuns on the bus throughout the United States, everywhere. We have Texas, Arizona, Louisiana, Georgia, New Jersey, to get Medicaid expanded because as the Supreme Court, you know, last spring they said it was optional. So we form little nuns on the buses, which are interfaith. It's not really nuns. We kind of took it from that one article, we are all nuns, we are all called to serve. So, and we've asked people who are members to come together and work with their governor and encourage their governor to take this Medicaid expansion. And they tell us stories, you know, and they write for us, and they come and they tell us. We also do political ministry days on a quarterly basis, which we either go to a food pantry or we go to places that, like we saw in the nuns on the bus, so that we continue to see who it is we're serving.
And Sister, let me interrupt you. Sister, let me interrupt you again. We have another call, this time on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with Sister Mary Ellen Lacey. Go ahead.
Hello, Sister.
Hi.
Could I want to try and represent the other side of this picture, and I want to make the case, and I want to make it stronger than I would make it myself, but this is a voice I'm not hearing today, and that's the voice that says these fathers and mothers came here illegally, and as a lawyer, you know that the law matters. Mm-hmm. What do we do with the fact that the children, I'm sure, they didn't choose to break the law, but what we have here is people that broke our laws, and the justice part seems like it needs to take into consideration that as well. How do you handle that?
I think that the question with regarding they broke our laws, it comes over and over again. But and there's two ways that I look at this personally, and I'm not saying they're the right answer. This is how I come to my conclusions with it. One, we are called as people of faith to look at a law. And if the law is unjust, to make positive change, we do have to do civil disobedience. Now, you may say, oh, no, we can't do that in this instance because look at how many people came over. But are you by any chance, you're a father, are you?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. So imagine yourself, you're in Juarez. Your kids are with you. Extremely dangerous. No way of, you can't eat, you can't find anything. Your kids are fighting gunfire. You see just across the border safety and good things for your family. But you're told your brother who's here is going to try to sponsor you, but it's going to take about 14 years.
You know,
is that fair?
You know,
is that right?
Yeah. I over the last 10 years, I work with a group of people. We've built 16 houses in Juarez. And I look at those folks, and we're trying to get them up off of their feet. But there is a limit to what a country can do. And maybe we haven't reached that limit yet. So that's where I would want to appeal. Okay, how much more legal immigration can we have? But at some point, we have to have a limit. And it is not unjust for someone to say, here's my limit. Much of this country is not Christian. They don't think that way. They have a right to say, no, this is our limit. Let's be generous. Where do they have a just right to say, no, it's not right for all these people to come across and squat and say, we're taking citizenship essentially by force. My grandmother and grandfather came from Norway, very poor, but they did it legitimately. They never learned to speak English very well, but they made a good living. But they came and they got citizenship.
Well, they probably came before 1965 when the INA was developed and imposed all these restrictions. You know, when we say our grandparents came legally, I don't know whether mine did or not, to be honest with you. I have no idea how they got here. But I also know that there was no real attention paid to immigration until probably the late 40s, and then in 65 was when the INA was actually written into law, and they developed a more rigid structure, which, like anything else that the government can do, it didn't work after a while. Now, should there be a limit? I don't know. I don't know what the limit is. But right now, to say absolute no, because I don't think that people, I don't know why we would think that that would be right or okay to say we could take advantage of this and you cannot. I don't see that as a matter of justice. I find that very unjust to say one is deserving of this, but you're not because we got here first.
So what do you do? Do you just let 30, 40 million people come across the border and you just take everybody into the lifeboat to the point that we're all struggling? You know, my friends are working in Memphis with refugees and illegal immigrants, mm-hmm. and they are swamped. They are just so weighed down, and this is Christian ministry. There are consequences to saying, oh, it's so unjust that these people can't come in. Let's flip it around. Let's get real about what the social system in America can handle.
But recently, 44 out of 46 economists said, by making the 11 million people here legal and by allowing them to work legally, that will improve our economy. And
okay,
35% of all new businesses are created by immigrants. So that, again, improves our economy. Now, are you talking we physically don't have the space for more people? Or?
No, it's the employment. It's the infrastructure. There was a guest on WILL AM 580 in the last month who said, listen, we did this a number of years ago. We said we would declare amnesty for the 3 million that were here. Now we've got 11 million, and we said we'd close the border, and that would be it. Now we're going to say it's 11 million, we'll close the border, and that'll be it. And the guest on the show really said, we've got to get down to the pragmatics of how many people can we take into the society. Right now there's a lottery overseas. My friend won it, 14 million people apply for 100,000 slots to get green cards for 7 years. Mm-hmm. My friend won, and he came here, and he's very proud of it, that he has worked and bought a cab, and he is going to make it. He just got out of college here. There are people that are working very hard to do this legitimately. And in Jit's case, he said, I just can't believe these people are just walking in. And I worked my butt off to get through the thing legally. So
I think we're going to have to interrupt here because we do have other callers waiting, but I think you've made your point. So
sure,
very well. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. Let's go to another caller, this time on line number two. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Sister Mary Ellen Lacey from Network, National Catholic Social Justice Lobby.
Hello. Yes.
Hi.
I think that the migration across the border in the Southwest is a special case. These people have actually been coming across that border, not for decades, but for thousands of years. In fact, we stole that land from Mexico, which had stolen it from the natives people. And most of these people are the native people. And I think it much more complicated than the previous caller would suggest. But the point is, we have these people here now, and to send them back wholesale would create a horrendous problem for the country they came from, for the people who have been living here. Many of the younger people have been here almost all their lives. Some have been here all of their lives. And the adjustment to life in Central America would be almost impossible for them. They're English speakers, not Spanish, and I don't think we can be quite as doctrinaire as he would suggest. We have to find a solution, and part of that solution is that we have to correct our behavior in Central America. We've been exploiting Central America for 150 years or so. The Reagan administration furthered the genocide in Guatemala, and this is a matter of record. And other administrations have also helped to support the tyrannies that were here.
Sure, the School of the Americas, or Weinstock.
So I think we can't solve it with quite that hard-hearted, practical attitude of the previous caller. We have to find a just way of doing this. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. And we do have another caller waiting, but I'll let Sister respond a bit more, if you'd like, before we go to the another caller.
You know, I think you make a great point there. Is we do, and part of all the lobbying I do, is we push for the new policy to include looking at the causes of migration. You know, as the caller stated, people have been coming over partly because we have gone into their countries and taken their water supply, and you know, we have the School of the Americas, and we're training junta to go down into the Latin America and cause problems. So we do own part of that responsibility. The other side of the causes of migration is how many do we pull over here as workers, and how many? We have 66,000, you know, worker visas, and yet we need hundreds of thousands, and the farmers take them and they bring them, and you know, it can't just be we bring you over, we use you for our purposes, and then you've got to go now. You know, that, and I think the last caller said that much more eloquently than I can. You know, we do have to look at our responsibility in this, and I just applaud his comment.
We're down to the last couple minutes. We have one more caller. I'll try to squeeze in on line three. Please be quick. Line three. Yes,
okay,
you're on the air.
And you mentioned School of Americas and our need for workers who will not do ordinary work that resident North Americans do. Speaking of, I think it was Clinton, in one of the first big illegal or WAP workers without papers, removals. Tyson Chicken, I think, which is not another Clinton Food Industries, was importing laborers for the plants throughout the South, without which you wouldn't eat a dollar a pound chicken. We don't have the workers for the tomato fields on the in the Carolinas. Why don't we just go to the trouble of building worker reception areas where we invite people to come, get cleaned up, apply for work, and when there's work that others will accept, pay for their shipping to the places so that they can do that. The other thing I would say really important is, Mr. President, get off your duff, tear down our wall, and tear down our iron curtain. It's sickening.
We're going to have to stop there, I'm afraid, with that question or that comment. Sister, any last two sentences from you?
No, I'm inspired when I hear people just interested in it from all views. And I don't think any person on the show tonight had a harsh view. I think everybody's searching for answers. And, you know, that's what's important. Stay in the, you know, stay in it and lobby. Make your phone calls. Make your, get in the acts of justice, you know, advocacy for it.
We did have one other caller waiting that unfortunately we will not be able to include because we are out of time and I have a couple announcements I do have to make. But let me first thank Sister Mary Ellen Lacey, daughter of Charity, from The Network, a national Catholic social justice lobby. You can learn more about it by going online to networklobby.org. If you don't have computer access during business hours, call 202-347-9797 in Washington, D.C. You can receive alerts via email every week from the network if you care to and find other many other activities are involved in and ways to be supportive. Thank you very much, Sister, for being on the program.
Okay, thanks for having me. It was nice speaking with you.
Appreciate it. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith, and let me just announce quickly that coming up at the Y, there is not a Friday forum this week, but at the University of Y at the University of Illinois, coming up on April 5th, will be Eboo Patel, founder and director of the Interfaith Youth Corps, a member of President Obama's advisory council. That'll be at the University of Y at noon on April 5th for Friday forum. And at the Reticus Forum, at the St. Andrews Lutheran Church at the University of Illinois, Irfan Ahmad, Professor Ahmad, will be speaking April 9th at 7 p.m. on faith and science in the Muslim tradition. I'm Steve Shoemaker. You've been listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 guaranteed hand-knotted authentic Oriental and Persian rugs from new to antique that complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a cleaning and repair service, located at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.